Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 267, The Torah Studio. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And before we jump into our conversation today, we want to wish you a happy Passover, or I should say wish a happy Passover to those listeners who observe. Passover starts tomorrow night, if you're listening to this on the day that it's released. And I hope that those of you who are doing or attending Passover Seders have a good experience. It's our second Passover in Zoom Seder land. We do want to note that we have a collection of Passover-related materials. Just go to www.jewishlive.org/passover-2021. And there you can find links to resources that we think are particularly valuable. I want to call attention to three of them in particular. One is the Plagues Project. It's a collection of 30-plus videos that we've done along with some partners. The second is something called Virtual Seder. It's a collection of about 75 really short videos, like 2 minutes each, that take you through the entire Haggadah or the entire Seder project. And you can watch them before Passover to get a little bit inspired and to come up with some ideas for your Seder, or you can actually watch them during the Seder. And the third resource that's there is a link to a few instructional videos about how to make your own matzah at home, particularly your own soft matzah. Yes, soft matzah can be kosher for Passover. And check it out. We actually have an Orthodox rabbi who is teaching you how to make soft matzah there. Again, you can find all that at www.jewishlive.org/passover-2021. Another thing that I just want to mention briefly is that a book that I translated, we've talked about it in the past on this podcast, called The Orchard, is finally out as an audiobook. So if you want to read a really interesting book about the beginnings of Rabbinic Judaism after the Second Temple is destroyed, and actually think a lot about how that time is similar to our time, I think that you really will enjoy this book. You can find it at audible.com as well as anywhere else that you might find audiobooks. Now let's shift gears to our interview for today. As you'll recall, we're in this series where we're exploring the Bible from a variety of angles. We've spoken to academic Bible scholars about their work and their discoveries. We've learned about how Karaite Jews relate to the Bible. And today, we're going to speak with an educator and entrepreneur who's trying to change the way that all Jews relate to the Bible. Our guest, Liana Wertman, is the founder of a new organization called The Torah Studio. The Torah Studio is a radically accessible and inclusive Torah learning space. It was created to be a place for people to learn Torah without having to leave any part of their identity behind. The Torah Studio believes that Torah is richer with your whole honest voice, sharing ideas, struggles, excitement, and joy. Liana Wertman was raised in Los Angeles across a variety of Jewish denominations. She began teaching as a teenager at the Ikar Spiritual Community and also as a counselor at the Gindling Hilltop Camp, which is one of the Wilshire Boulevard Temple camps. She's been working with Jewish children and teenagers for over a decade. She's also studied herself, although she likes to emphasize how much of a what we call a regular Jew she is. She's taken 3 years of Talmud classes and is reaching the intermediate level of Biblical Hebrew. And as she says, she recognizes a lot of Aramaic words. She spent a summer studying at Pardes Institute for Jewish Learning in Israel and also at the Hebrew Union College Summer Beit Midrash. Before starting the Torah Studio, she worked for 2 years at Temple Israel of Hollywood as the youth director. And now, as she's starting up the Torah Studio, she's also doing a side gig as a full-time student in the Masters of Jewish Educational Leadership program at the Rhea Hirsch School of Education at Hebrew Union College under the tutelage of our previous guest, Miriam Heller Stern. I should also say Liana is a longtime listener to Judaism Unbound, who we connected with years ago because she did some amazing synthesis and sketching of our Ten Commandments of Jewish Innovation that we talked about long ago. So as always, we're really excited to welcome a longtime listener, first-time caller to the podcast. So Liana Wertman, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's a real thrill to have you as a guest on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about why it's called the Torah Studio? Like, what is the art happening in this studio?
The Torah Studio does not make any art yet. We also don't do any yoga yet, but that is kind of what we're modeled off of. Basically, our business model is what a yoga studio does. We are teaching Torah every single week, multiple classes, different teachers. We are doing that every single week. And you don't have to sign up for a large amount of classes in advance. The yoga studio model has really been a way for me to make sure that I'm creating a space that feels accessible for people so that they can be practicing Torah and learning the skill and making it a part of their life that feels nourishing.
So I want to get into that a little more deeply. I'm curious, just the way that you put it is so interesting. So when you think about Torah in the same category as yoga, I think about yoga and I kind of understand what yoga is for. It's a practice of some degree of exercise, some degree of centering, of breathing, of bringing calm. When I think about Torah, I tend to think of it as, not saying that only I think of it this way, I think most people think of it as something that you do in a different way than we think about yoga. When you think about a Torah practice as something that I might just drop in on occasionally in the same way that I might do yoga and have a really great experience doing it that once, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm now going to do it every day. Could you talk a little bit about your sense of what Torah is and what Torah study is all about?
Torah study is something that we all should have access to. Whether you try it once, like at a yoga studio, and that was enough, you did it, but you knew you could do it. You went and you tried it and you were able to do it. Maybe it was hard, maybe it was awesome, but once was enough. But the fact that it's then available at other times means that you're really able to build up a practice on your own. So even if we don't activate it, even if we don't actually use it, we should all feel that we're allowed to and have access to Torah. It is what we're building fences around, or what we're trying to take fences down from, which is a quote from Pirkei Avot, where they talk about building a fence around Torah. We are trying to build a new Judaism, build a stronger Judaism. And I think Torah should still be at the center. And we need to be in conversation with it. We need to at least feel that it's available to us, whether we're rabbis or people just considering that we're Jewish for the first time. It's our text.
Okay, so Dan already went the name route and asked about the studio side, the Torah side. I'm just like really into it because we've talked about different kinds of organization names. I love the name Torah Studio. I genuinely love the name Torah Studio. I think it is clear in a certain sense, but also like just the right amount of mystery. Like, okay, Torah Studio. So this is something related to Torah. And I assume that I would, if I'm accessing this organization, you know, interact with the five books of Moses like that. And that's true. And studio, in the ways you're talking about, it hints that there's like an experimental avenue or set of avenues that you utilize. So love the name. Quick yes or no question, and then I'll ask the full question. Is the relationship between Torah study and studio, like the phonetic relationship, is that on purpose?
It is not on purpose, but I kind of felt like it was the modern, easily accessible version of Beit Midrash.
Cool. Okay. So I'm curious, when somebody accesses Torah through you, what is different about it compared to somebody accessing it through somebody else? So you've talked already about how you fashion your classes so that people can access not just as like an ongoing series, but actually each one can resonate just on its own, which to me resonates a lot as somebody who makes this podcast. And like, we try to play it both ways, right? Like, we try to have this be an ongoing conversation between episodes, but we also want somebody to listen to us one time ever and have that matter. And I think that's like not always the most popular thing to say in Jewish organizational spaces, because the idea is like, we're sort of doing this fight to like get Jews to like do Jewish and like continue to do Jewish for an ongoing period of time. And so saying, oh, you just do it once and that's awesome. Why is it that you sort of orient that way? And what are some of the other ways in which Torah Studio is different from Torah studies at, you know, a synagogue or a JCC, wherever it might be?
I think that text has been kind of put on a high shelf, literally, for how we're allowed to access Judaism. That people who are just starting to figure out what is important to them, or just having that inkling that Judaism matters to them, are trying to find their avenues into a Jewish life, into a Jewish identity. And text often gets laid out as, oh, that's what you do when you've already joined the synagogue and you've already have your community and you already feel really confident. Then maybe you can come to Torah study and we'll talk out the difficult things that you're going to find in there. That intellectual practice of studying Torah that is also very emotional in a way that I don't know that I'll ever be able to fully explain is such a beautiful way for some people to enter Jewish spaces because they want to know something before they start. They could jump into my class and say, text is the way that I was missing for feeling Jewish. Or they'll go, yeah, that's awesome. I'm glad someone loves it. And they'll go find another way because they know that this was there and they know that they tried. And I didn't make them feel bad for not loving this. And I didn't make them feel bad for doing something else. And I think it's really important that people have multiple avenues for entering Judaism, multiple ways of feeling Jewish and practicing out that Judaism. Same goes for somebody who is on that 10th step and is trying to see, do I like Torah? Do I like this kind of practice? I think there's also a level for me of bringing down the yeshiva, which is like a traditional Jewish study center that is usually meant for Orthodox men, to the everyday. And not just to the everyday because we're not Orthodox, but because we have other jobs and because we have other things that we love and care about that sometimes get in the way of Torah study, whether that's the once a week class that's happening, or maybe once a month class that's happening at a 20s and 30s group or at a synagogue or a JCC. If that Wednesday doesn't work, that's your Torah for the month that's out. And that was something that I was really hitting a lot. I was working at a synagogue. I was really into Torah. I had a lot of connections in the Jewish world in Los Angeles, lots of rabbi friends. You know, I was like exactly the person who should have been able to find studying Torah easy. And I couldn't, because every time I was trying to find a Torah class, something would come up that Wednesday every 3 weeks. And even if it didn't, 3 weeks wasn't enough. I wanted it every day, honestly. I mean, this is why I started it, but I wanted it all the time. And if I couldn't find Torah study that was consistent enough, then how could somebody who's trying it for the first time or thinks maybe they like it?
Well, we think a lot about why somebody isn't doing something Jewish. It's like, oh, well, they're not committed enough. They're not interested enough. It's like, no, maybe it's just that it takes place on Thursdays and they're not available on Thursdays. And that's the only time it's offered. It actually reminds me of some of the questions. The questions that I'm going to ask you reminds me a lot of the questions that people tend to ask us, which is like, well, if you're doing it in this way, in our case, online, that is much more accessible and therefore much more likely to be accessed as the numbers prove, but it's not worth it because you're losing something really important in doing it that way. And online, you're losing community. The way that you're doing it with drop-in Torah study, you're losing the long-term going through it with the same people over and over. And, you know, I always say, well, look, there's loss and there's gain. And yeah, I'm not going to deny the losses that you talk about, but I'm also going to emphasize the gains. And let me tell you about how we do it here so that maybe you can get excited about it. So I'd love to understand a little bit, especially now that you've launched this during COVID. So obviously it's all taking place online. And I want to ask how you mean it to be after COVID, because it's more clear that if you do something online, there's a lot more likelihood that people can drop in anytime and somebody will be around. So I'm curious if the vision is really that, no, this is an online project for exactly that reason, or there's a vision that at some point after COVID, there would be an in-person dimension, and how would that work?
So I came up with the idea for the Torah Studio about 2 years ago. I remember, Dan, when we got coffee one time, the first time we met, I told you about like the nascent beginnings of this idea of how are we going to teach Torah to a new generation of Jews and like really bring it to people. And it always in my head had been in Los Angeles, which I think is a space that is ripe for Jewish experimentation that no one is really jumping in on, or not enough people are jumping in on. And that it was going to be in person. I was going to have like a Beit Midrash, which is like a house of study. It was going to be a big open space with tons of books, because that's like the greatest place in the world for me. And then I started it in COVID, and I had to totally change what I understood this project to be. And it was better than I could have imagined, because I have been able to access people across North America. We have a lot of people coming in from Canada. And we're definitely missing the community piece. I think there is a small community that's building in the same way that there's a small long-term group that's building. The same way that a temple Torah study on Saturday mornings has like that core group of people that you walk in and you know they've been there for 15 years. You are going to come into one of my classes and there are going to be people who have been there every single week for months now. We've only been around for months, but it's mostly my family. But they're the best. And so, you know, you have to have these give and takes of the long-term practice of Torah study being lost for the one-off. And what that imbalance is making me focus on is making sure that every class that I offer is really seriously rooted in a feeling of Torah study, that there's not time wasted. We're giving everybody exactly the tools that they need to be fully engaged in a Torah study, really no matter how many times you've done this before, whether it's their 100th time or their first time.
And how does that work? Tell us a little bit about how the classes themselves work.
So every single class and every single class that we'll offer, the core piece of what we're doing, in my opinion, is Chevruta time. Chevruta comes from the Hebrew word chever, which means friend, and it is the term for partnered learning. It means that you're not learning totally by yourself, reading on your own. You're reading with another person, and not just for 5 minutes you're reading the text at each other, but we spend more than a third of our class, which sometimes is 35 minutes, sometimes it's 20 minutes, depending on how long the class is, in chevruta, which means that you and one, maybe two other people are breaking down the text however feels best for the two of you, going through every single line, every word that's interesting to you, every big idea that's coming, just getting to be immersed in that text. And we make sure that every person has the tools that they need to be in Chevruta, like I said, whether it's your first time or your 100th time. And that means you have multiple translations of the text so you can cross-translate. And if you don't know any Hebrew, you're really getting kind of a sense of where maybe there's some tense Hebrew translations going on. You are given guiding questions and guiding steps for how to work through this text with your partner. Now, I don't use source sheets because I want people to just be focused in on the Torah text. If I walk into your breakout room or pop into your breakout room rather for your Chevruta, and you're pointing on something cool, I might give you another text or a direction to follow that I think you'll appreciate in that moment. But really, you could go through the entire time and just use the Torah. And then we come out and we have a discussion all together that I let the learners lead mostly. I mean, of course, I'm guiding and helping and shaping a bit, but whatever was really coming up and is the most important for people in that moment is what we're going to be focused on. As we're studying through Exodus, people are thinking about what does it mean that God is hardening Pharaoh's heart? Or when we were studying Genesis, we're thinking about the fallibility of our ancestors and the process that we are witnessing of people failing and getting these second chances and having these second sons and all these things that people have heard about, but haven't really read necessarily themselves or haven't read closely in a long time. And what that means is that we're really opening up text from what the learners are seeing and letting that be the guiding force.
So I'm really struck by, you mentioned that Torah learning is emotional, not just intellectual, in a way that's hard to explain. That's the first little passing phrase that you mentioned that I think is really deep. The second is, it's mostly my family. You mentioned, you know, there's sort of a hardcore group that is there each and every time you meet, or many of the times you meet, and like that, a lot of it's your family members. I want to sit with that because I'll be honest, I think there are a lot of us for whom, you know, I share all sorts of Jewish things with my family. And growing up, I shared holidays with my family. We like went to services, not every week, but sometimes, like there are Jewish cultural things, like all of that I share with my family. I don't think, other than I guess you could sort of count the Passover Seder, but like I don't think we've ever really studied Torah with each other. Not that we've ever like been avoiding it. I actually think that my mom and dad, I'm an only child, so that's my nuclear family. Like, I think they would love the idea if I said to either one of them, like, hey, I'd love to learn Torah with you. But there's something powerful in the idea that we could have as like a family interaction. I'm understanding that like it's not just your family in the room, but like that matters because I think that it's counterintuitive that we would share that realm of Judaism. I think like I'm picturing all the different Torah studies I've gone to, and like most of the people in the room, it's like one person, like their spouse isn't there. It's like individual people who are all excited about Torah study, and like maybe there's a couples who both like Torah study and both go, but a lot of the people there, it's like they're there on their own because it's their thing on Saturday morning and their spouse does something else. And then afterwards, maybe they schmooze about it. But I'm curious what comes up for you when you specifically share this with people you love, whether that's your literal family or others.
At first, I thought that they were coming just because they love me and they're being supportive. But 3-4 months in, I was pretty convinced. Also, they told me they're doing it for themselves. And I think one of the reasons that it happens that people aren't studying with their families or studying just on their own in these groups is there tends to be a hierarchy in Torah study and really a sense of jargon and trying to get in. And there are certain doors that are locked and you have to jump over certain hurdles to prove that you deserve to be in the rooms that are studying Torah. And if your family member has a vague interest but has never done this before, it can be really difficult or stressful or just not fun for them to join in a Torah study where they're going to feel very out of depth and not really heard or excited. And it takes a certain kind of person then to jump into those spaces anyway. And I think one of the things that we work really hard to do is create a non-hierarchical Torah space when we're in discussion or when we're in chevruta. And I make it very clear to everybody before we actually start talking. I share that whether there are rabbinical students in the room, which often there are, or people studying for the first time, again, often there are, that every single person is here because this Torah matters to them. And every person is bringing their own set of experiences that matter for Torah. It is what is going to make our Torah beautiful together. Whether you feel really confident about what you said, just because it's in your gut, or whether you feel that it's good because you know that Rambam and Rashi, two Torah commentators from the 11th and 13th centuries, are also saying. Bringing both of those in makes it beautiful and makes it rich.
It reminds me of a story that I've probably told before in the podcast, but, you know, 5 years in, I can retell certain stories. But at one point, many, many years ago, I was running an organization and our staff would study Torah together. And we were studying this particular story about Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, and when he visited Moses, and he gives this famous advice about how to organize the people into a kind of pyramidal leadership structure. But there's this part before it where Jethro comes and Moses tells him what had happened to them, how they got out of Egypt, and then it's been really hard since then. And Jethro gathers all the elders together and sacrifices an animal, I think, and says, you know, your God is the greatest of gods. And they basically have a meal together. And I said, you know, well, I think what's happening here is that Jethro is throwing a party. And what he's saying to Moses implicitly is you're a bad leader because you're a real downer and you can't be a downer and be a leader and you have to get the people's emotions up before you do anything else. And so he's having a big party. And I said, you know, I kind of get that because I'm kind of an introvert and I'm not necessarily the best at doing that kind of thing. And so that actually feels to me like really valuable leadership advice as much as the more intuitive you should organize the people into groups. I mean, that's not that complicated, but the idea that you throw a big party, that might be something that you have to learn as a leader if it doesn't come naturally to you. So one of my staff members turns to me and says, which commentator did you get that from? And I said, well, no, I mean, I just was reading it and I'm having this experience because I'm a relatively new leader in the organization. And I'm kind of seeing that the one thing that I'm not doing well here is throwing parties. By the way, I'm still not very good at that. And it spoke to me, you know, and she says, you can do that? And I said, well, I guess so. I mean, who's going to stop me? But it was interesting that it never really occurred to me or I had gotten past the point where it would have occurred to me that there's any question like you could do it. Can you do that? I mean, I could do whatever I want. But she, who was from a much more traditional experience in Jewish education, it was a lesson to learn. It was something to realize, like, because you've been educated that if a Maimonides or, you know, someone else didn't say it, then it can't be valuable. And so I'm curious how, you know, to understand more about your experience, you talked about how you try to give people the sense that whatever comes out of anybody in the partnership is a valuable piece. But I know that people have such obstacles to believe that. How do you actually go about the process of making them believe it?
So one of the things that I do at the beginning when I give everybody the info they need to be in Chevruta is I show them a graphic of a triangle that I got from Eli Holzer and Orit Kent called The Philosophy of Chevruta. And it's called the, you know, the Chevruta Triangle. And it's the three responsibilities that you have in a Chevruta moment, in a partner learning space. One responsibility is to yourself, one is to your partner, and one is to the text. And that, I think, is the key that a lot of people are missing, is that the text is a partner in your conversation. What that means is you're reading the text carefully and you're letting it have its own voice in the conversation, which means when you like what it says, you are digging into that word, to that sentence. And when you don't like what it says, you are also making it speak for itself. And when you're really focused on what the text is saying, if you can say what you're saying and then go, yeah, see, this word right here is what made me think of it. Doesn't matter if it's the first time you've ever seen that word. Doesn't matter if you know what that Hebrew word is. It matters that that word spoke to you. And you know that what you're saying is based in text. It's also based in your heart, but it is based in the text. And I think that process, for somebody who is very experienced in learning in a much more traditional way where commentators are ruling how they interpret, and somebody who's never looked at Torah before, both of those people are going to relieve of themselves that they had to be correct because the text said it. You saw it, the text said it.
I mean, this is a weird connection, but I'm remembering early in my relationship with my spouse, my favorite Torah portion happens to be the story of Balaam and Balak. And she, at this point in our relationship, she didn't know that story, which I think is very logical. Like, it's sort of this weird commercial break in the midst of the Book of Numbers. It's like, it doesn't sort of take the story forward. It's just like a funny interlude. Although I'm sure people could argue with me about that. But I did an exercise where I worked really hard to hide my own biases. And I asked her, like, okay, we're going to look at this story together. And I'm curious, on a scale from 1 to 10, with 1 being like evil and 10 being a saint, like how would you value, like what value judgment would you put on the character Balaam? Traditionally, all those commentators and lots of Jewish takes and whatever, have a very negative approach to the character Balaam, to the point that when they read the initial story, in my view, they see the story through colored lenses and they see this character in a negative way because they sort of decided to beforehand. My argument, and it turned out she gave like, I don't know what it was, like an 8 or a 9. Like he comes off pretty well if you're not looking at those commentators, if you're just looking at the text. And it was important for me to see that because it showed me just how much of a twist the commentators often bring to the stories. And that's not necessarily bad. There's lots of Torah stories that I actively want to twist and that I actively want to change the message of. But people don't always realize how, on a basic level, like we take for granted Esau is like a bad guy in the book of Genesis and Jacob is a good guy. Like read those stories without any glasses on. And I think either one of those characters can be seen as good and either one can be seen as pretty evil. So Why is it so important in your group? I've given, you know, my take. Why is it so important in your group to stick with that? Because obviously somebody listening to this could be like, but wait, Lex, you talk about finding connections in Jewish text to like pop culture or to other things. Like, why would you sort of restrict yourself?
Yeah, it happens to the best of us to get totally stuck in commentators. And by the best of us, I mean every incredible rabbi that we've been learning from for the last few thousand years. But it has definitely put me at like butting heads with some of my chevruta in the past to say, I'm going to question the commentators. And what that means is when you find in the text something beautiful, like you're sure that Balaam is the number one dude in all of Torah. If someone came into class and said, the way I just read Balaam in my chevruta is that he is the number one dude that I have read about in Torah. I love him. I want to be like him. I would happily put in front of them a piece of commentary that said the exact opposite. Not to say, boom, that's the answer, you're wrong, but to say, great, this is how other people have read it. Going back to the text can you make their point, or do you still feel like you can hold your point? And where do you think they got it from? And coming back to the text really allows you to be in that exact conversation that the commentators were having. And it's also about the understanding, and I say this very often in my classes, there is no final answer in Torah. Every time we come to the text, we're reading it a little differently. A new word is popping out to us. Rashi hits a little different that day. All of it is going to change and evolve with us. And so it's about being in the conversation and having the skills and building those skills and building the confidence to be in that conversation at all.
Can you talk a little bit about your own background? Because I think what's interesting in this particular conversation is that all three of us launched initiatives of various kinds before we were, quote, authorized in any way. Now, unfortunately, Lex has recently become authorized and
the worst
and graduated from rabbinical school. And unfortunately, you are enrolled in a program where you're going to get some kind of degree of Jewish educational leadership. And what can you do? And I'm also wondering, the real intent of my question, not the real intent, but an additional intent of my question is this question of like, is what you're talking about in terms of helping people believe that their voice is actually important. How does that relationship change once you, as you become more authorized, whether that's by a degree or just by more and more experience? I mean, I think the more years that you're doing it, even if you're not authorized, you know, like me, you still learn more and more and more. And so you become more intimidating potentially. So I'm wondering how we avoid that as we do endeavors like this, which are really meant to help unleash people's own voices.
I grew up studying Torah in like the most casual way possible. My dad was starting his own Torah learning journey and was going to Torah studies very often and was coming home on Friday nights and telling us what happened in the Parsha. And I loved it. And basically since then, I have been the person who at any conference or summer camp activity choice jumped in and said, I'll be in the Torah class. I would love to learn more. And a few years ago, I decided to study more. I started learning Talmud with a regular Talmud study group in English. I started reading Torah on my own, having conversations with rabbis around me, just like doing everything that I could to teach myself. And I hit a point where that no longer was working. It's around the time that I came up with the Torah Studio. So about a year and a half ago, I took the opportunity to go to Pardes in Jerusalem. It is a place that is an egalitarian Jewish learning, Beit Midrash, yeshiva, all those words that are coming up. It's a Torah learning space and it just clicked. And then I came home and I kept studying and I have just been immersing myself in Torah as much as I can. And that does mean that I don't have that kind of authority that people want or expect from a Torah scholar. Now, who's to say that I'm not as knowledgeable as somebody in their second or third year of rabbinical school if they came in for other reasons than that they had really immersed themselves in Torah so far? I think that there is a really important aspect to having people that look and act and are just excited like you are teaching you. I have been a teacher, I'll say that. I worked at summer camps my entire life. As a teenager, I worked at a religious school. I ran a youth program at a synagogue. And so combining my passion and my love for Torah and combining my passion and love for teaching just felt very natural. And as I gain more skills that make me feel more confident and that make other people feel more confident in me, when I'm moving through a discussion with people, I'm giving information as I feel is necessary. When I walk into your chevruta and you tell me about a really cool word you just discovered, I ask people if they want to know the Hebrew before I just tell them. Because sometimes you're like, no, I'm good. I like my interpretation. I don't speak Hebrew and I don't need to know what the Hebrew is because maybe you're going to tell me that it's wrong. But most of the time people do want to know. And I just use the resources I have because as a teacher first, seeing the light and the joy that chevruta and then discussions bring to people to be in this conversation is something I hope I never forget about because that is always going to be my central point. You know, now I'm on Judaism Unbound, so it's going to be a little more intimidating for people in class. But
really though?
Yeah, exactly. But I do think there's a mix of needing some authority for people to trust that they can learn with me. And also that piece of I'm learning with them. I hope should never leave me.
I think this is so important. I think we haven't talked about this directly enough in the past, so I'm grateful. First off, like little side note, what you said about sort of somebody not wanting to know the Hebrew and like their interpretation being based on English, like I think we have a lot to learn from Christian approaches to the King James Bible, where the King James Bible in English, like in certain senses, sort of is the thing. You could tell them literally the word in English is like not truly a representative of the original Hebrew or even like, and people don't care. It is its own holy scripture at this point. And I think we have something to learn from that as Jews. Like, I do think we should treat our English texts as also having their own weight. And it's not that I don't want people to look at the Hebrew ever or gain meaning that way. But anyway, so that's one thing. I think this point you're bringing up about intimidation, or that Dan brought up, or that we're talking about, is so vital, because I'm going to be honest, I think that as much as there are things that you and I and Dan and others with like a public platform can do to sort of minimize the amount of intimidation that we sort of wield, I think at the end of the day, no matter what I do, each year of me gaining experience, each year of you gaining experience, like there is a way in which that is always going to increase the intimidation. And what my takeaway from that is not like a fatalist notion of, ugh, it's all screwed. Like we need actively to be looking for people who are not experienced educators, who are on the younger end and who are maybe not on the younger end, but like newer to Torah, whether that's Jews by choice, whether that's people that are just newer to Torah for whatever reason, they need to be teaching. We need to buck the idea that like the best teachers are those that have the most knowledge. It's not that having knowledge is the worst thing, but like there are ways in which somebody having new eyes or newer eyes on these stories is actively a plus. And where I, even as you know, I'm 30, I'm not, I haven't seen this for 60 years, but like where I, having gone through this process, like I sort of know my takes about each Torah portion. Like it is absolutely possible that I'll look at a Torah portion next time and something new will arise, and small things do. But like, if I'm really being honest, I don't know that like the percentage of my stuff that comes up that's new is anywhere close to somebody who is seeing it for the first or second or even fifth time. And that's a reason to have that person in the center of the room and not just in the side of the room, because when they say their thing, they're going to have an energy, they're going to have an excitement, they're going to be able to transmit it in a way that somebody seeing it for the 11th or 14th time may not. And so I'm curious to hear like what it looks like in your space. Like, are there ways in which the roles are not always sort of you teaching? And also what you would say about this in general when we think about Torah study.
I am the main teacher right now, but I do have an incredible teacher teaching with me one class this season of Exodus, and hopefully in the future, Rebecca Chess, who's a great friend of mine. And the idea is that like a yoga studio, there's going to be lots of teachers. And I want to be finding the newest, coolest, excited teachers, whether those are people who are teaching for the first time or want to experiment with a new type of class, and they are really highly praised educators and not rabbis, or rabbinical students who are just starting in their journeys. And in classes themselves, like I said, I try to have no hierarchy. And so while I am not having somebody lead a discussion, the first question I usually ask when we leave Chevruta and go into discussion is, all right, what was coming up? What are the hot takes? Lay them out. What was crazy? What was upsetting? What was exciting? Just say it. And that means that a lot of people who see this for the first time are the ones who are going to speak up and say, why would God do that? Why would Abraham do that? And that energy is what I'm trying to get out with that question, because that's when the people who then have learned this a lot of time kind of feel that spark again. Whoa, I've never heard somebody say it that way. You know, like you hearing about Balaam from your partner, like, oh, I didn't realize you could think that way about this. And, or when my grandma goes on a 5-minute beautiful drash on something and everybody is just sitting there and getting to hear it. And I mean, my grandma is an elder in our community, but she is very new to Torah and loves it. And I think that that's part of it, is as we're listening to each other truly and honestly in discussion, we're all getting to be in that presence and that energy and that joy of somebody who's studying for the first time. And that piece of us comes out, including from me. I'll hear stuff every single class that I had never thought about, was not what I expected people to be focused on, was not what I expected anybody to have thought of or reference or bring into our conversation. And I feel so grateful every single time for those comments.
You know, I don't want to focus on this, but I do want to put, as B'nai Lapi says, a sticky on it, or to at least mention this whole business about your grandma and your family, I think actually is huge, because what we've been trying to talk about on Judaism Unbound, and where my head is more and more, is in a space that's somewhere between a person who's just doing something on their own and an organization that needs $1 million of funding. And that starts with some kind of small group. Like, imagine starting an organization not as starting an organization, but as starting it as a small group, and then it just naturally becomes an organization over time because more and more people get attracted to it. And it feels to me like the ultimate example of that is just doing something with your family. And, you know, here your grandmother becomes a superstar Torah study student, and then she's bringing all her friends and whatever. And over time, that's how these things naturally grow. And I often think that, some of the desperation of the Jewish community and of Jewish funders to have something exciting makes everybody flock to the idea of starting a new big organization, as opposed to funding or facilitating lots of amazing experiments like this. It just feels very natural and very exciting to me, this whole idea. So I just wanted to kind of flag that. You can talk about that if you want, but I also wanted to go back to this other comment that you made about just being a natural teacher. Because as you were saying that, I was thinking about, again, what if we reorient our understanding of Jewish education, or at least a certain segment of Jewish education? And I'm also wondering, by the way, are they talking about this at your education school, where it's much more important whether somebody is a good teacher than what they know? And that's for two reasons. One, people can always learn new things. They can't often learn to be a great teacher. And number two, maybe especially for newer students in an area, you don't ever have to know that much. In other words, my really amazing fifth grade math teacher probably doesn't know the kind of crazy proofs and whatever that my son is now studying in first year calculus. You know, I don't even know what he's talking about. And I think that when you say things like that in Jewish education, people tend to go, oh, you're dumbing it down. You know, you're not taking it seriously. And I'm saying, no, there's actually different things that are useful at different stages of connecting with this material. And it actually may be that at a certain point, when you learn too much, you are now no longer appropriate to teach introductory level students anymore because you know too much. What if we thought about it that way? Then how would we orient the structure of Jewish education differently?
Well, I think a key difference that's happening here versus in a lot of other Torah study spaces is that we often go to Torah studies that are led by a person that we really admire because we're there to learn their Torah. But what I'm really trying to do is find out what you see in it and do everything I can as an educator to uplift and make you feel excited and passionate and empowered to see what you need to see in that piece of text. But I think as I start to look for more teachers, and why I picked Rebecca in the first place is because they agree that the purpose of trying to get other people to find their confidence and their beauty in Torah is why you're coming to the Torah studio, is what we're trying to do as a space. Yeah, I would rather find a really good teacher with just enough background to maneuver around to figure it out, then I would find somebody who is excited to tell everybody all of their incredible theories. No judgment, incredible theories. I don't have anybody in mind, just to be clear. I would much rather find out what my students have to say than what a teacher has to say. And I think that that's an experience of Chevruta that doesn't always get translated into other Torah study spaces.
The more that I'm hearing from you, maybe I'm like creating this narrative, I'm hearing that it makes sense to me that you were a camp counselor. The way that you're talking about Torah study and the way that you're talking about facilitating groups, it feels similar to, I mean, I was a camp counselor for a few years, and it was at a Jewish camp. So I think about that experience in the context of, you know, the work I do now in Jewish spaces. And I say now, and I think I've said in the past, and I think I'll say you know, in decades, that in certain ways, the most important work I ever have done and maybe ever will do is that I was a camp counselor. If I'm a parent, I think that will be a more important thing. But like, until then, it's a remarkable role. And there are ways in which what I talk about is like the constant yes and, the constant improv game of summer camp counseling, where like, you are constantly doing everything in your power to take whatever comes out of a camper's mouth and have it shift the space, have it contribute to the camp culture, have it like that feels similar to what you're describing with wanting to help people find their Torah and have it not be about you. Because as a camp counselor, if you're focused on you, that's a real problem. So I guess, am I off my rocker here, or do you draw connections between your camp counseling? I'm using counselor as a verb in the same way I use Rebbe as a verb, Rabbi as a verb. Do you draw on that experience in how you facilitate these Torah studies?
You couldn't be less off track. I don't think there's anything in my life that I do that doesn't feel like it came from camp. But this energy came actually, I think, from my experience as a CIT director. So I was in charge of the counselor and training program for 3 years, and it will forever be probably the best job I've ever had, because I took this group of 17-year-olds who love camp with their entire heart and are also 17. And over the course of 2 months of me teaching them and giving them tools and working with them and building relationships, they went from there for camp because it's for them, because they love it, because they're trying to have their best time, to people who were actually ready to take care of other human beings and make camp about other human beings. And it was about empowering them with the tools that I have to make them the best counselors possible. But the humility of, they are their own people, and they're not going to just look like mini me's running around being counselors. They're going to look like their version of counseling. And it really made me think about, if I'm not trying to teach somebody how to be me, I have to give them tools that they can use to make themselves different and better and stronger. And I think that that definitely comes into my teaching of Torah. I'm not looking to give people my Torah. I want to give people tools that they can use and immediately absorb so that they are actively doing it on their own. And I have to have that humility to say, I don't get to control what they do with it, which is the hardest thing. It's hard for us when we talk about the Jewish future. It's hard for us when we talk about our kids. It's hard for us when we talk about our work or a tweet. Once it's out in the world, we don't get to decide what's going to happen to it. We just have to do our best to make sure that people are given the tools that they need to be their best version of themselves. And all of that comes from, shout out to Gindling Hilltop Camp. Clap, clap. You have to clap at the end of it. Up in Malibu. Well, no longer. Unfortunately, both of the Wilshire Boulevard Temple camps burned down a few years ago. But those are my homes, and they will forever be the reason I am who I am.
I'd love to talk a little bit about what the Torah is in a paradigm like this, because it strikes me that, especially when we think about who we're talking to in this series, that if you talk to academics, they're interested in the truth. What really happened? You know, what's the actual historical fact here? If you talk to people that are coming from a more traditional approach, they're like, no, I understand. I'm not even that interested in the text. What I'm interested in is what the commentator said about the text or what the Talmud said about the text, because that's actually what created Judaism. And I'm interested in practicing Judaism, you know, and the idea that we're coming to the Torah with neither of those mindsets, that we're coming to the Torah just to read this text. And in some ways, it's like a mirror, or however we might think about it as a metaphor. Is there a way to see this as a new way of being Jewish that actually surprisingly didn't exist before? Because when in history did anybody ever read the text of the Torah and, you know, regular people, and think about what they thought about it? Like that I don't think has ever been a practice in Judaism until recently. So then is it something new, or how do you see the role of Torah, the purpose of Torah, when you're committed to an educational approach and an approach of, like you say, it's not really about education, it's about practice, like yoga. So this is your Jewish practice. So what Judaism is it?
So I think this also answers Lex's question from a while ago that I did not answer yet about what that emotional piece of Torah is. Torah as a story, and then as a written book, and then as something that we've passed down, has been the core of Judaism for likely more than 3,000 years. And the fact that we, not even that we can because we like to, but that we can because people are still reading it at all, and it's still relevant 3,000 years later, is nothing short of a miracle for 1,000 reasons, right? I mean, thinking about how hard it was to even get here, that this book had to keep being worthwhile and read, and that rabbinic Judaism had to keep it at the core. All of those things to me, when I read Torah, I feel connected to that entire lineage, to all 3,000 of those years. That whether this is your spiritual or literal ancestor who was reading this book or not reading this book, this was the book they were or were not reading. This is the book that they were doing the mitzvot from or not for all of time until we got here. And to be part of that conversation, not just with commentators who are only 900 years old, but with people who are the rabbis, with people who we just assume were having these same feelings and conversations, or if not the same feelings, then the same inclinations to question and elaborate and grow from, is so special. It's such an honor and a blessing to be a part of that on any given Wednesday night. Being in conversation with the text, no matter how you're doing it, is what I'm trying to create. Because if we can have a regular, casual, easygoing conversation with Torah as part of our lives, then it becomes either the thing that we are deviating from knowingly, or the thing that we are bringing with us knowingly as we build a stronger, new type of Judaism, new vision of Judaism, with Torah still at the center.
In this conversation and in many other Jewish conversations, we have used the word Torah in two very different ways, and we have not fully explained the differences between those two ways. And I think, A, note to Jewish educators and rabbis and everybody, like, we should explain what these ways are when we're doing it, because I think it's confusing to Jews and especially those who aren't Jewish. But first off, we have used the phrase the Torah. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, you know, those are five books that collectively make up the Torah, you know, with that definite article, the. Next level is sort of Torah, which still with like a capital T, which I think sort of refers to, this is less clear cut, but it sort of refers to those five books and like the Rashis you've talked about and like the commentators, like sort of traditional sources that are relating to the Torah, but are not themselves sort of the Torah. I think sometimes people say Torah and they mean that realm. The third way, which I am deeply interested in and which you used before beautifully, is talking about Liana's Torah, my Torah, your Torah, which is not Liana's five books of Moses. It's not that. I think it's this deeply intimate, it gets at the emotional pieces, right? It's this deeply intimate idea of sort of someone's almost like soul teachings. It's a very deep idea that like people have within them teaching that like must come out, their Torah. And in facilitating a space like this, or even as being a participant that's not facilitating in a space like this, you can come to understand what it is that is your personal Torah. I would love to hear from you a little bit about that distinction between like lowercase t Torah, an individual person's Torah, and the Torah, the five books. Because I think that as much as we're doing this unit of episodes on like the Torah or on the Bible more generally, long term, we are as interested or more interested in how the Torah can sort of mobilize people's Torahs, people's individual Torahs, as we are in that set of five books.
I really appreciate that distinction, because I think I do sometimes play on that people know that there's different levels of Torah being a part of this conversation. I teach Torah study, capital T Torah, five books of Moses Torah once a week, but I used Torah in Torah study knowing that it was an expansive understanding of the teachings of our people, because Torah means the teachings. It means the fact that what God taught us on Sinai is where that comes from. There's also a belief that what God taught us on Sinai was both the written Torah capital T and expansive T, and also oral Torah, the Torah that we're passing down. And I think I like to include our layer of Torah, my personal layer over Torah is part of oral Torah, is part of that tradition from Sinai down till now, until I got it and I can add my layer of Torah on top of it, that Dan can layer his layer of Torah on top of his Torah, and all together, that mixing all of it together. And I hope to be teaching all of that. I hope to be teaching literal five books of Moses, Talmud, Tanakh, which includes the other two sections of Torah as we understand it, which is writings and prophets, all the while with the understanding that you are building your own layer of interpretation, your own oral Torah, your own way of how that affects your morality, how that affects your life, how that just affects the way you read that word, layered on top of what you're reading. Nourishing both of those feels very important to me.
This has been awesome. For folks who are hearing this and are like, A, I want to go to Liana's awesome session, with the caveat of what you said before, it's not just about learning your Torah because you're great. It's also about them finding their own. But if they want that, how could they do that? And B, if they want to connect with you to start up something comparable, how would they do that?
So you can find us at thetorahstudio.org or on Instagram at Torah Studio. And you can email me at thetorahstudio@gmail.com. I'd be happy to talk about what your Torah means to you, how you want to study Torah, or how you want to teach Torah. We're on Zoom for hopefully forever if we're also good to be in person, which means that you can come to one of our classes and I would really love to learn with you.
Thank you so much, Liana. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you so much. This has been a dream come true.
Wow, we love that it's a dream come true. Thank you again, Liana. Thank you for all of you out there listening. One little note before we fully close out the episode is that the Torah Studio and Liana Wertman were partners of ours on our Purim initiative this year, Purim Live, which was just a huge success. And we actually have the full video recording of that event. It was this wild journey through all 10 chapters of the Book of Esther. We have that recording on our website. We encourage you to check it out at judaismunbound.com/purim2021. And we hope that you'll stay tuned because there may be other collabs coming up between the Torah Studio and Judaism Unbound. Those are on the horizon before too long. Anyway, now we will close out this episode. There are a wide variety of ways that you can be in touch with us if you have questions or thoughts or really anything related to this episode or any other. And we love when we hear from listeners. And here are all those ways. First, you can go to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can hit up our Twitter or Instagram, also just at Judaism Unbound for those handles. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always email us at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. We are, of course, greatly appreciative if you're able to send us a donation of any amount. You can do that just as a one-time gift, or you can set up a monthly recurring donation via judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.